Today we will study the two primary heroes of the Purim story, and that is, of course, Mordechai and Esther. And I hope to explain the differing characteristics of Mordechai versus Esther, what type of person Mordechai was in the story, what type of person Esther was. And we will go about it by asking a few basic questions about each of these individuals, and by answering the questions, hopefully we'll develop a certain picture of what type of person and what type of personality each of these individuals was. So Mordechai, his name is connected with the word Marduk. The Marduk was a Babylonian god. The Das Mikra explains that Jews who were exiled in Babel had non-Jewish names. And I think when we think about what kind of person Mordechai was, and what types of behaviors, what did he do in the story of Purim? Were there any questionable tactics that he used or questionable behaviors that he engaged in? I think that we could point to three behaviors that I think we would question regarding Mordechai. Number one, why did Mordechai command Esther not to disclose her identity when she was selected to become, I guess, one of the candidates to be Ahasuerus' wife? Number two is, why does Mordechai refuse to bow down to Haman? And number three, why does Mordechai tell Esther, when he hears about the decree to wipe out the Jews, why does he tell Esther, you got to go to the king right away, even though the rule was that if you went to the king unannounced, you could be killed? And Esther hadn't been called for 30 days to the king, and why didn't she simply wait until a point in time when she would be summoned by the king instead of putting her life at risk there? So I think those are three questions regarding Mordechai's behavior during the story. Number one, why does he command her not to disclose her identity? Number two, why does he refuse to bow to Haman? And number three, why the rush in Esther trying to foil Haman's plan? So, regarding the first question, Mordechai commands Esther not to disclose her identity. Now, the Ibn Ezra writes that some say Mordechai did not act correctly in commanding Esther not to disclose her identity because he was concerned that the king would not take her as a wife if it was known that she was from the exile. This obviously takes the view that Mordechai wanted her to become the queen, which is certainly not necessarily indicative from the text. Others say that Mordechai prophesied that salvation would come as a result of Esther, but Ibn Ezra disagrees with both of these positions, and Ibn Ezra says very simply that Mordechai wanted her to observe the Torah and Halacha in private, and had the king discovered that she was Jewish, he would have forced her to eat forbidden foods and to violate the Shabbos. Here she could quietly and secretly keep Shabbos and keep kosher without arising suspicion. Rashi points out that Mordechai had a different plan, that Mordechai didn't want Esther to tell of her ancestry, that she descends from Shaul, in the hopes that the king wouldn't want her. The Megillah says, "Vatilakach Esther Malkah," she was taken, and the implication is by force. She didn't want to become a candidate to become the queen, but she was taken by force, and he didn't want her to become queen, and so he told her not to tell her of her ancestry so that the king wouldn't want her. So this perhaps could explain Mordechai's request that she should not disclose her identity. Of course, according to Rashi, once Esther was selected, why wasn't it an issue for her then to disclose that she was Jewish? The whole reason, according to Rashi, was that she shouldn't be selected, so why now disclose her identity? For that, maybe Mordechai knew that this must have come from God. It seems, if we examine and explore some of Mordechai's behavior throughout the story, it seems that Mordechai may have thought that this was the fact that Esther was chosen is from God. So maybe at this point he wanted to tell her, even after she was selected, just hide your identity. This is meant to be. And how Mordechai viewed the different goings-on and the different stories of what happened, the unusual events that happen, that they come from God, we see in perhaps one way to understand Mordechai's reaction to Haman and Mordechai's plan to Esther. Because when we ask ourselves, why does Mordechai refuse to bow down to Haman? Why didn't Mordechai bow down to Haman? Why does Mordechai put himself in a situation where he endangers all the Jews simply because he doesn't bow down to Haman? So Chazal say that Haman had an idol fixed to his heart. And so maybe, again, Mordechai does not want to bow down to Haman. And by the way, where does Chazal get this idea that Haman affixed an idol to his heart? Rashi says that Haman referred to himself as a god. Where do they get this idea? It could be consistent with what the Das Mikra explains, that we find very often Gedolei Yisrael would be mishtachav and would bow to non-Jewish rulers, but the Lashon in the Megillah, v'lo yichra v'lo yishtachaveh, kriya and hishtachaviya, is something that we only find by God. So this Mordechai believed was avak avodah zarah. This was related to avodah zarah. Because of this, Mordechai Mordechai is willing to put his life in danger in not bowing down to Haman. Of course, the question is that right? That Mordechai is putting his life in danger. Why does Mordechai have to pass by Haman each and every day? Why can't Mordechai take another route to work? Why does he have to specifically walk in front of Haman and not bow down to him and put his life in danger? Ibn Ezra actually rejects the premise of this question. Ibn Ezra is of the view that Mordechai would have wanted not to pass by Haman every day, but he was not permitted to leave the Shar HaMelech, so he had to pass by him every day. However, there's another way of understanding this, and this could be related to Mordechai viewing that there's a big picture going on here. It could be that Mordechai sees his brethren bowing down to Haman, and he must take a stand, even if he is putting his life on the line. Mordechai recognizes that there's a danger and to Klal Yisrael, that this is not simply a struggle between Mordechai and Haman, a game of chicken between the two of them, who's going to flinch first. Mordechai is not going to bow down to Haman and see if Haman's going to react. Mordechai sees this as an ideological struggle. Once Haman affixes the idol of himself on the breast of his heart so that everyone, including the Jews, would bow down to him, Mordechai saw that Haman came in the name of religion. Haman wanted everyone to worship him as a god, so Mordechai could not bow down to him. Mordechai had to stand up for his nation. And what this means probably is that everyone else rationalized and bowed down to Haman, saying they're just bowing down out of respect to the viceroy. They're not bowing down to an idol. Mordechai felt that he must act. Mordechai, the fully Persian Jew with the non-Jewish name, who seems to have completely assimilated into Persian society, Mordechai refused to bow down to him. And now Mordechai is called an Ish Yehudi. What's interesting is that in Perek Beis, Pasuk Hey, Mordechai is called both an Ish Yemini and an Ish Yehudi. Rashi says that he's called a Yehudi because he was exiled with Malchi Yehuda, and he's called an Ish Yemini because he's from the tribe of Binyamin. However, the Gemara in Megillah tells us that Yehudi is someone who is kafar b'avodah zarah, someone who rejects idolatry. And this is Mordechai, who specifically refuses to bow down to Haman. And Mordechai, the Ish Yehudi, understands that this is not simply a physical struggle between Mordechai and Haman. This is an ideological struggle. And more than that, Chazal see that Mordechai understand that Mordechai is descended from Shaul. Haman is a descendant from Agag that Shaul did not kill. So according to Chazal, Agag fathered a child when Shaul spared Agag for a day, and this child turned out to be the ancestor of Haman. So again, we have this ideological battle. Shaul does not kill Agag, and years later, we have Mordechai pitted against Haman. And the Das Mikra actually also points out that in both the battle against Amalek and against the enemies in the story of Purim, the Jews did not take any spoils. And there's a requirement to write this story in a Sefer, as is the requirement following the Amalek story in the Torah. So perhaps Chazal understand that what's going on here is Mordechai, who is refusing, is specifically walking right up to Haman and saying, "I'm not bowing down to you." It's an ideological struggle between the Yehudi and the Amaleki. Had Bnei Yisrael all bowed down to Haman, that was okay to Haman, because bowing down meant assimilating into Persian society and disappearing into Persian society. It means, as the Gemara in Megillah tells us, celebrating an Achashverosh's big party and endorsing his worldview that the Jews will not return to Eretz Yisrael, the dream of another Beis Hamikdash is dead, that Persia should become one large melting pot. But Mordechai refuses. Mordechai refuses to attend the party, and he refuses to bow down to Haman. This man is trying to create a spiritual holocaust, not through force, but through deception. That's Haman. And once Haman fails, Haman tries a different plan to destroy the Jews. He hates the Jew, and he hates Judaism. Now, still, you can ask the question. It's one thing for Mordechai to put his life on the line in order to try to stem the tide against the Jews all becoming assimilated. But is it appropriate that he puts all the lives of the Jewish people at stake, at risk, because of his refusal to bow down to Haman? You could argue that Mordechai was not fully aware of the consequences of his actions. He thought that he might be putting his life on the line, but he couldn't imagine that anyone in their right mind would wipe out an entire nation because of Mordechai's actions. And then, if that's the case, because again, if you think about it, who in their right mind would think that because I'm not bowing down to you, you're going to try to wipe out my entire nation? That's an unreasonable assumption. And this could be why in Perek Dalet, Pasuk Aleph, Mordechai is so devastated when he hears what happened. He rips his clothing, because he totally did not anticipate that as a result of his failure to bow down to Haman, he could deal with himself being killed and him being a martyr and perhaps being a positive example for Claudius, for the Jewish people. But that the whole Jewish people, the lives of Jewish people, should be at stake, that was something that was unanticipated by Mordechai, and that's why he is especially devastated. So then we come to our next question with Mordechai. Why the rush in his plan for Esther? Esther is willing to put her life on the line to meet Achashverosh. So why shouldn't she wait until he summons her? After all, the killings of the Jews are not scheduled to take place for another year. This is the Haman in the month of Nisan drew a lot that said that in the month of Adar, the Jews will be killed. So at some point, Esther will be summoned. By coming to the king unannounced, she may put her life in jeopardy, and then certainly there will be no Jew in the palace to save the Jews. Why the rush? And perhaps this is Esther's claim to Mordechai when he asks her to go to the king. She tells him, "I have not been called in 30 days. The Megillat Starim explains that she asked Mordechai, "Isn't it better to wait until she's summoned to the king?" And Mordechai says, "No, risk your life now." But why? Why the rush? It seems that Esther has a legitimate claim. So perhaps, according to the Megillah Starim, Mordechai says, isn't it better? Mordechai says, "Mi yodei im la'eis kazos hi gata l'malchus." So, I'm sorry, Mordechai says that maybe you only became the queen for this particular purpose, so you should save Klal Yisrael. See, ever since Esther, again, and we can look at Mordechai's response in one of two ways. Perhaps Mordechai believed that this was really the most appropriate time to right now approach the king. Because what has been happening recently, Achashverosh's life has been threatened by Bigson and Teresh. So Achashverosh appoints Haman as his deputy and orders that everyone should bow down to him. We have not seen anyone else have this much power who is not king. And then when Haman asks to kill the Jews, Achashverosh not only grants the request, but he gives a ring to Haman. Haman slowly is becoming the real power behind the throne. And meanwhile, Achashverosh is becoming more and more isolated. Esther beforehand presumably was permitted to go to the king without permission when she told him of the plot against her life. But now nobody could come to see the king without permission. Haman is becoming more and more the face of the kingdom, and Achashverosh is slowly becoming more and more of a figurehead. And Mordechai realizes this, so he tells Esther, Mi Yodea, who knows if the king soon won't get rid of you like he did to Vashti? Who knows if soon Haman will have so much power that you will be unable to convince the king to kill Haman? Or maybe Haman will discover Esther's true identity. Time is of the essence, according to Mordechai, even though 11 months are left until the decree against the Jews to be carried out. And even though Esther is potentially putting her life at risk by coming to the king unannounced. Maybe also the king has many meetings with a lot of people, a lot of ideas. So if Esther would request a meeting with the king, he might not take her request so seriously. So maybe Mordechai's request to Esther that she should come in unannounced, that's to create a sense of urgency, that she's willing to put her life on the line, that the issue that Esther is about to raise is very important. So maybe we can look at Haman's request that Esther come to the king right now as a tactical move. Maybe additionally, again, maybe because the letters are just going out to the neighboring provinces, that in 11 months we're going to kill the king, we're going to kill the Jews. So maybe since the letter is only about to go out now, maybe if she overturns the decree right now, the letters won't arrive, or the new letters to undo the first letters will perhaps be able to come out in a way that people won't start becoming anti-Jewish or anti-Semitic. So one can view Mordechai's request to Esther to come to the king now as a tactical request. However, maybe we could understand it as something else. Maybe this is Mordechai as being a man of faith. He's a straight man, a man of faith. He refuses to bow down to Haman. He walks up to his face, and he's not bowing down to Haman. And then when he sees that Haman, so in such an almost unnatural way, because he's upset at one person, decrees that the whole Jewish nation should be killed, Mordechai sees there's something else going on. And ever since Esther became queen, Mordechai must have been asking himself, why? And Mordechai is searching for a sign. He tells Esther, don't disclose your identity to the king. Hold off. There must be something going on here. There must be a reason. There must be a reason why of all the women chosen, Esther was chosen. And then 5 years afterwards, Mordechai understands. This is the reason why Esther was selected to become the queen, to save the Jews. And once Mordechai found the sign, he truly believed that everything would turn out okay. He forces the issue with Esther to go to the king immediately. Again, maybe for some of these tactical reasons, but a miracle is in the eye of the beholder. And Mordechai sees unusual event number one, Esther is chosen to be the queen. Unusual event number two, as a result of Mordechai not bowing down to Haman, Haman decides to wipe out the entire Jewish nation. He realizes this is obviously why Esther becomes the queen, and he is full of confidence that Esther will be successful. This is, I think, how we understand Mordechai's character, Mordechai's behavior, willing to be straight and unwavering, even though, again, he is very high up in the ranks of the king and in the royalty. He's a top advisor, he's a top official in the Persian court, but he, at least according to Chazal, he is unwavering in his faith to God, and he's willing to put his life on the line in order to stand up for what he believes, stand up against Haman. And he's so confident in HaKadosh Baruch Hu that as soon as he finds out about the decree, he knows this is why Esther became queen, and he's confident that Esther will be successful. So who is Esther? Esther is also called Hadassah. And Esther is probably her foreign name. Perhaps it is connected to the Babylonian goddess Ishtar. And in fact, that's one of the suggestions in the Gemara. Her Jewish name presumably is Hadassah. The Gemara, again, as I mentioned, has a whole host, not just the reason because she's Ishtar. The Gemara has a whole host of reasons why she is called Hadassah. When we think about Esther's behavior during the Megillah, so I think that we are struck with two major questions. Number one is, why does Esther invite Achashverosh and Haman to two feasts? Once Mordechai convinces Esther that you got to do something, she invites Achashverosh to not one, but a second feast before she tells Achashverosh that someone's trying to kill her and her people, etc., etc. Why two feasts and not one? And the second question is, we have to try to understand how she is permitted to have relations with a non-Jewish king. And according to Chazal, she was married to Mordechai. The simple reading of the text of the Megillah is that they were cousins or close relatives. And Mordechai took care of her after her parents passed away. Over Rashi, based on one opinion of the Gemara, believes that they were married. And of course, that compounds the problem of her living with Achashverosh. Perhaps you can argue that the Lashon, where did Chazal get this notion that they were married, says that Mordechai took her as Labas instead, and so they read it as not Labas' daughter, but Labias as for a house. Maybe the Lashon of Lekacha that the Megillah uses in turn that may refer to marriage or hints at marriage. Here was a young girl who had no prospects, no father, no mother, and presumably, maybe Chazal understood that for someone who has no prospects, Mordechai, who's a close relative, so what do you do with a young girl who has no prospects? So Mordechai, who's a close relative, marries her, because otherwise no one's going to marry someone without any parents, without any money. So Mordechai, who was someone related to her, married her. Of course, that creates a much greater problem. And how is she allowed to have relations with the king? Initially, it was by force. She was taken. But when she decides to seduce him in her attempts to convince him to overturn the decree of Haman, so then it's the Gemara says that now it's Baratso. Now she's going to willingly have relations with him. The question is, how is she allowed to do it? How is she allowed to do that? The Gemara asks the question, says that even according to the view, even let's say she wasn't married to Mordechai, nevertheless, there's a halacha that if someone wants to commit a sin, befarhesia, in public, known, then even one of the non-three cardinal sins, even a sin that's not one of the three cardinal sins, you cannot violate it if the sin is befarhesia, if the sin is in public. So we have to deal with two different questions. Why the two feasts? And number two, they're having relations with a non-Jewish king. So, first question, the plan with Haman. Why not simply send word to the king to meet him and tell him what Haman is planning? Again, apparently, the rule must have been that even a wife couldn't send the message to the king. She maybe you can argue she was just an object. Maybe she had to be invited by the king to speak to him. Seemed the fact that she couldn't even come to the king and she was afraid that she'd be killed meant that she needed to be cunning. Also, it seems that she may have had much less standing to advise the king than did Haman. She maybe understood that the king wouldn't do what's right and good, that he's only interested in personal considerations. So I think there are two different ways, actually, to understand Esther's behavior, that she didn't tell the king what Haman was planning and how it's affecting her until the second feast. I think either you can look at it as tactics, or you can look at it in terms of she wasn't fully convinced that she would be successful until the second feast. So let's first analyze the first approach. So maybe the reason why she invited the king to two feasts instead of one is she wanted to, quote Rashi. Rashi said that Esther wanted to make the king suspicious, because not only does she invite Achashverosh to a party, she invites Achashverosh and Haman. Now, Haman is very powerful. And we know that there was already an attempt in the king's life, which likely prompted the law, that any unauthorized entry into his inner courtyard would result in death. Rashi believes that Esther was playing on the king's sense of insecurity and wanted to create some distance between the king and Haman before she disclosed her identity. If Esther would have immediately told the king that Haman was plotting against her, then it is likely that the king would choose Haman over Esther. After all, the king had killed his queen beforehand, and Haman was his most trusted servant, especially if you believe, according to Chazal, that Haman was Memuchan, who advised the king to kill Ahasuerus, to kill Vashti earlier. Therefore, it was imperative that before Esther spring the news, that she should create some mistrust between the king and Haman. And therefore, Esther creates jealousy and intrigue in the palace of the king. She invites the king and Haman to two parties. And the king must have been thinking, why invite Haman? Perhaps she wanted to raise suspicions about the loyalty of Haman. And the truth is that even after Haman is killed, Esther still has to beg the king to spare the Jews. Now, Rashi's position seems to go hand in hand with the position of Rabbi Shua ben Korcha in the Gemara and Megillah, that she thought that the king might believe that Esther and Haman were conspiring against the king, so the king would kill both of them, in which case she believed that the decree would be canceled in any case. Also, by the second time, Esther is more of an equal. The first time, if you read Perek Vav, Pasuk Hey, the Megillah says that Haman and Ahasuerus come to the party Asher Asusa Esther, that Esther made. She's serving Ahasuerus and Haman together. But the second time, in Perek Zayin, Pasuk Aleph, the Megillah states that Ahasuerus and Haman come to drink with Esther and Malka. She's no longer a waitress, but they drink together. There's a greater sense of comfort that she has. Additionally, with Haman present, she could catch Haman off guard, so he would not have time to think of a plan to counteract Esther's plea. I think that's one approach to understand Esther's behavior. A second approach could be, the Ibn Ezra believes that she was planning to tell the king at the first party, but she was waiting for a sign from God that God had heard her prayers and that God had seen the fast of the people of Shushan. It is true that the king did not kill her when she approached him unannounced, but she needed a stronger sign that God was on her side. In other words, perhaps Mordechai, once he sees two very unusual events, Esther chosen to be queen, Haman decides to wipe out the Jews, he sees this as God written all over it. This is completely supernatural, and obviously Kadosh Baruch Hu made Esther the queen so she can deal with the Haman problem. And so he has complete faith that Esther will be successful. Maybe Esther was not so easily convinced. She needed a sign, so she wasn't fully convinced. Because what happened between the first and second parties? Haman was forced to lead Mordechai through the streets. So now, after not only was she selected to be the queen, and not only did Haman make a decree against the Jews, but Haman was forced to lead Mordechai through the streets, she believes that Haman ultimately was going to fail. She now had full faith that she was going to be successful. She was ready to tell the king who she was at the second party. She saw the sign of God, and this sign made her a complete believer. According to the Ibn Ezra, Esther also was searching for a sign. She found the sign. She was strengthened by that sign, a different one than Mordechai, or she needed an additional sign. And she had the courage and the faith to plead with the king at the second party that resulted in the downfall of Haman and the salvation of the Jews. I think these are two different approaches to understand why Esther waits and doesn't disclose her obvious concern and disclose the fact that Haman is trying to wipe out her people until the second feast. We're left with one more question. Why does Esther have relations with a non-Jewish king? And again, as I mentioned, it's especially problematic if you take the view that she was married to Mordechai. So some Amoraim take the view that this wasn't the problem. Abaye says in the Gemara in Sanhedrin that she was a passive participant. A woman is a passive participant in the act of intimacy, and therefore she was not, she didn't violate a sin. Rava said that normally, even if someone commits a sin, normally, even though, let's assume maybe she wasn't married to Mordechai. So again, but still a sin to have relations with a king, who's doing it in a public way because everyone knows that they're married. So, normally speaking, you can't commit a sin, any sin in public, befarhesya. But that's only if the non-Jew forces you to commit a sin in public in an effort that you should abandon your religion. But here he was doing this for his own pleasure, his own benefit. So this is not a violation. So you can look at Esther's behavior again as saying that technically this wasn't a problem under the circumstances. However, there's another approach to understand Esther's behavior. Even if she was married to Mordechai, the Maharik says that what she did was legitimate because her goal was to save all of Klal Yisrael. Normally speaking, you're required to give up your life rather than commit three cardinal sins, rather than sin in public. But the goal here was to save all of Klal Yisrael. And she was allowed to commit the sin of Gilui Arayos, even if it meant, obviously, it's a tremendous sin in the abstract. She's allowed to do that to save all of Klal Yisrael. The Zohar says that Yom HaKippurim is Kippurim. Yom Kippur is like Purim. And the Zohar specifically makes this comment in Perek Hey, Pasuk Aleph of the Megillah, when Esther is entering into the king's chamber to invite him to the party. And the Zohar tells us, lest you think that Esther is entering the inner chamber to conduct herself in a sordid manner, Esther's putting on the royal garb is just like the Kohen Gadol dressing in the priestly garments. Yom Kippurim, Kippurim. Esther enters into the inner chamber just like the Kohen Gadol. In this way, Purim is like Yom Kippurim, when the Kohen Gadol is clothed in beautiful clothing, similar to Esther putting on the royal clothing, and Esther found favor in the eyes of the king, just like the Kohen Gadol finds favor in the eyes of God, and immediately God heard and God forgave. So, what does this mean, though, that Esther was like the Kohen Gadol in Yom Kippur coming to visit the king? So perhaps we can understand that Esther is taken by force to take part in a beauty pageant to determine who is to be queen, but there's no ordinary beauty pageant. According to the Megillah, each contestant spends a night with the king and then has to remain in the palace. And one woman is chosen to be the queen. So Esther is forced to have relations with the king. She's chosen as queen. And she continues to be forced to have relations with the king. And she is initially completely passive. But when she finds out about the fate of her people rests on her shoulders, so what does she say? V'chein avo el ha-melech asher lo kadas. She will come to the king lo kadas. On one level, it means against the law, because you couldn't come to the king if you weren't summoned. But the Midrash and the Gemara understand that she's now changing her tune towards the king. She will now have bia. She'll now be intimate with the king willingly. She will try perhaps to seduce the king to save her people by being intimate with the king. That she's going to come in asher lo kadas against the Jewish religion. And then she says, V'chasher avadati avadati, and just as I was originally lost to my father's from my father's house, now I will be lost from you, Mordechai, because now I will willingly have relations with the king, so I will no longer be permitted to you. Esther is giving up any future with the Jewish people because she agrees to willingly submit herself to the king in order to save her people. The Midrash Lech HaTov actually goes one step further. The Midrash Lech HaTov explains, V'chasher avadati, that just as I am lost from you, Mordechai, avadati avadati gam ani nafshi, my soul will be lost. I will give up my portion in the world to come. Esther here agrees to commit an aveira, a sin, but not just any sin, one of the three sins, sleeping with a non-Jew. And according to the view that she was married to Mordechai at the time, she agrees to commit adultery to save her people. So comes the Maharik and says, this is an Aveira Lishma. She committed a sin. It was justified because it led to the salvation of the nation. Now, the Maharik argues that it is true that for an individual, one may not transgress the biblical prohibition of adultery, but to save all of Klal Yisrael, she was even allowed to sin with Achashverosh, and the Maharik calls this an Aveira Lishma. And Rav Tzadok of Lublin understands the Zohar like this. Esther enters the inner sanctum of the king, motivated solely by love for her people and her desire to save them. She enters as the Kohen Gadol. Esther's deeds might cost her the world to come, just as Aaron HaKohen's sin in the episode of the Cheder Egel might have cost him the world to come. After all, one reasonable way of understanding the story of the golden calf is that Aaron willingly built the calf because he realized that if he would stand in their way, they would kill him just as they killed Hur, and they would be leaderless. Better that Aaron sin and build the calf and be punished for it and save the people from even greater destruction. And in both cases, HaKadosh Baruch Hu accepted their sacrifice, understood their total devotion, spared the Jewish people because of their sacrifice, and elevated them to a new status. Aaron became the Kohen Gadol, and Esther became just like Aaron, the Kohen Gadol that day. Yom Kippurim Kippurim. Aaron like Esther. So, if we think now about Esther's behavior, the heroism of Esther, her sacrifice for the sake of Klal Yisrael, and we think about Mordechai and what he was willing to sacrifice, his own life, for Klal Yisrael, seems to me that Mordechai represents the straight man who's not afraid to take a stand. He was perhaps the only Jew in the Persian court. Mefarshim say that after Haman was killed, Mordechai was next in line to be advisor because he was the wealthiest after Haman. Yet Mordechai does not participate in the prohibited feasts. He's very straight. He's willing to risk everything and take action to stand with God and to stand with the Jewish people. Esther represents the cunning person who transformed herself into a heroine when she was inspired by Mordechai, and she's able to beat Haman at his own game, perhaps by using a bold halachic position about saving Klal Yisrael and engaging in potentially questionable behavior for an ultimately greater cause. And perhaps Mordechai and Esther stand for the position of Hakol Kol Yaakov Vayadayim Yidei Esav. Sometimes you need both Yaakov, the voice of Yaakov, and the hands of Esav to defeat the enemy. Sometimes you need both the straight and you need the cunning at times to defeat the enemies who want to destroy us, at times physically and at times spiritually.